From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're talking about the bitchification of women in the 90s. You remember how the 90s was supposed to be the decade of the woman? Well, the journalist Allison Yarrow looked into this, and she says, that's not what happened. What happened is women who were looking for power came to be seen as bitches, and that word was used as a weapon designed to hold them back. She'll join us to explain what happened in just a moment.
Keeping KUER on the air isn't easy, especially when you have to go up a mountain. Here's our engineer, Lewis Downey.
The road was icy, and when you ramp up on the snow, your tires aren't touching the ground anymore. So you were sitting here feeling really dumb. This truck happened to have a winch on it, and I found a scrawny little scrub, and I hooked the winch line onto that, and that held while we could pull ourselves back onto the road.
Let Lewis handle the snow. Help KUER get some traction before the fun drive. Go to KUER.org and click donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. No matter how much you hear it in popular culture, even when it's used casually or playfully by women, the word bitch has an edge to it. As an insult for women, the journalist Allison Yarrow says it's been around a long, long time. In the 90s, she noticed it was used a lot in music and the media, even marketing. Yarrow came of age in the 90s, but when she began exploring that decade, investigating the way women were treated at that time, she says she was shocked by what she calls this bitch bias or this bitch narrative. In the 90s, she writes, bitchification was like water flowing into every crevice. She found it everywhere she looked. Her new book is called 90s Bitch, and she joined us recently to talk about it. Allison Yarrow is a journalist who's written for the New York Times, for the Washington Post, and Vox, among others. She joined us from a studio in New York City. She says women remember that first time they're called a bitch. In fact, in the book, she has her own story.
The first time that I was called a bitch, I turned around and slapped the caller in the face.
Yeah.
She was a friend of mine. We had gotten into an argument about a boy, and she called me a bitch, and I just knew in my bones that that was the worst insult you could call a woman.
So give me a sense of what the word meant to you at that particular moment.
I understood it to mean sort of a constellation of things that women were taught not to be.
Yeah.
And that was a slut, that was someone who was angry or vicious or malicious. And I felt like I was being called all of those things at once. And then my reaction was an incredibly angry one. And then I was immediately ashamed of my reaction because, you know, as I write in the book, girls are not supposed to hit. We're not supposed to outwardly express that kind of anger. And that's exactly what I did. And so then on top of feeling the sting of the word bitch, I just felt ashamed.
Yeah. Do you think those conflicting ideas about it kind of express a lot of what's going on in the book? It seems like there are these competing sentiments and ideas at play.
There are. I think that one thing that was interesting for me to look at when I returned to the 1990s, I grew up during the 90s. I was 8 years old at the beginning of the decade and 18 years old at the end. And I experienced it as a human, as a girl growing up in the Deep South of the United States. But I'm a journalist. I've covered gender for about 13 years. And when I returned to it with that lens, everything looked a bit different to me. Mm. I was surprised to learn about the origin story, actually, of the word bitch. It sort of dates back to ancient Greece and Rome when people would insult women by calling them, saying that they begged for sex like dogs. And etymologists believe that that was sort of the way that the word came about.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of the first definitions of the word bitch that was written down in an English dictionary described it as the worst appellation you could call an English woman,
yeah,
worse than a whore. And what I took that to mean was that, you know, a bitch was sort of worse than a whore, because a whore at least was paid for sex.
Yeah.
But a bitch would give it away for free. And if we fast forward to the uses of the word bitch now, they were everywhere in describing women during the 1990s. But also there have been these efforts to reclaim the word bitch, even by women, to say, you know, resting bitch face, or to bitch, or boss bitch, that somehow this word can be made ours and can be used. But I think that there are still these negative threads that exist in the word bitch when we use the word today.
Yeah.
One of the things you write in the book is that we can no longer ignore the history of bitch. Is that what's happening right now, this idea that we're ignoring that history?
We are ignoring a lot of history. When I returned to the decade, I kind of led with feelings of, well, I'll say this. I started to return to the stories of women who I had strong negative feelings about. So when I was growing up in the 90s, I loved the Spice Girls and I loved TLC and I hated Brenda from 90210. And so I wanted to explore what was sort of driving that hatred. And when I returned, you know, to her story in particular, it was very clear that there was a narrative making her into a bitch, not just the character of Brenda on the show 90210, which in many ways allowed the male characters to have jobs and robust lives, and the female characters were sort of graded on their sexuality and their sexual performance and really couldn't be anything more than objects. But also, there were ways in which Shannon Doherty, the actress, was also made into a bitch by the media narrative. And what I came to find was this was not limited to her. This also was used to describe Hillary Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, Anita Hill, Nancy Kerrigan and Tanya Harding, Marcia Clark, the lead prosecutor in the O.J. Simpson trial, Lorena Bobbitt, Amy Fisher, who were characters in the tabloids during the 1990s. So any woman that I write about in the book, and even the ones that I don't write about in the book, were subject to what I call bitchification,
yeah,
which was this kind of sweeping process that made any woman who had power, was reaching for power, was in politics or entertainment or Hollywood or the news, made her into a bitch.
One of the things that you mentioned is that you started researching it not long after Hillary Rodham Clinton announced she was going to run for president again. This was back in 2015. What was it about that particular moment that made you want to start looking into a narrative that you had identified in the 90s?
Well, Hillary Clinton had decided to run for the presidency, and I began to wonder, as others did, how this run might be different than her previous one.
Yeah.
And so that was sort of leading me in some ways. You know, in the 2008 election, she didn't really sort of grasp on to the idea, the historic nature of her candidacy as a woman. But she did begin to do that in 2015 and 2016. I also began to see just these BuzzFeed quizzes everywhere that asked things like, which 90s bitch were you?
Yeah.
And it was surprising to me to see that the decade was, you know, coming back for reconsideration and sort of given nostalgic treatment. So I wanted to explore sort of those forces at work. You know, I am always looking for the stories of women and sort of where are the women, who are the women. And I wondered, you know, if there was a story of women in the 90s, what would that story be? And that's kind of how I began to sort of who were the figures that we thought about and that sort of consumed our attention. Mm. And then what sort of linked them together. And as I returned to the historical record, the, you know, the news articles and sort of television and political speeches, and what I began to find was that what sort of united these stories was bitchification,
yeah,
was turning these women into bitches. And it's worth mentioning sort of the media revolution that allowed for these depictions to really firm up and lodge themselves in our memories. So during the 90s, you saw the onset of the 24-hour news cycle,
yeah,
which really just changed the way that we consumed the news. After the Persian Gulf War, There was this infrastructure, and you know, news organizations soon found that it was much cheaper, and audiences were more interested in covering Hollywood and scandal and politics than they were war. And so, stories about these women, they were told over days and weeks and months and years.
Yeah.
And we were all watching these stories unfold at the same time, the, you know, the white Bronco chase, mm-hmm. and the Anita Hill hearings, and, you know, Monica Lewinsky's testimony. And so these women were sort of, they were relentless content in this new media landscape. And we really have yet to kind of examine the effects of this, not just on people growing up in the 90s, but the millennial generation on the whole.
I think people forget what it was like before this new media landscape emerged in the 90s, created what you describe in the book as this unrelenting fixation on public figures. And this was interesting, too, and you mentioned this, and I hadn't thought about it, that one thing that was new about that landscape in the 90s, this, you know, 24-hour cycle, was that for the first time, we started consuming the same stories at the same time. And that was different. And I had forgotten about that. Like, that was the new original thing, as opposed to us sort of going off into our newspapers and reading the things that interested us. We were seeing the same things. So we all became fixated.
Absolutely. And we became fixated on the women.
Yeah.
The women really became sort of these characters and these villainesses in various forms, whether they were in Hollywood or politics or the news. It didn't matter who they were. They sort of they were centered in this negative way.
What do you make of this kind of nostalgia for the 90s that's going on right now?
Nostalgia is a common emotion, really, that we all share. I don't know if I'd call it an emotion. We all have nostalgia for the period of our youth.
Yeah.
And, you know, researchers looking at brain imaging have said that that's, you know, that it's not unique, and it tends to sort of cloud our critical minds. So when we think back to the time when we were coming of age, for instance, in one study, they looked at music. So those of us who grew up in the 90s are far more likely to love music by New Kids on the Block or Smash Mouth or Lauryn Hill. And it's not because this music is any better than music being produced now. It's just that we listened to that music at a time during which our brains were developing in a particular way. And so we have a particular affinity for those kinds of songs.
Yeah.
And it really, it's a very strong feeling that we can all have. But I think our 90s nostalgia in a lot of ways, I mean, it's coming back and it's everywhere. You know, Roseanne was sort of breaking ratings records before she was forced off air for a racist tweet. We've been investigating Anita Hill and Marcia Clark and Tanya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan through award-winning films and television shows. But we haven't, I worry that our 90s nostalgia is kind of seeping into a kind of 90s amnesia.
Yeah.
We've forgotten sort of how badly these women were treated, and we're slowly beginning to reassess their stories individually. But I believe that we need to look at all of their stories together, because then we start to see the similarities in the ways that they were treated, how they were relegated to very specific tropes like the bad mom, the bitch, the slut, the backstabber, the woman who's incompetent or too competent or too feminine or manly. And once we begin to look at all of their stories together, and what unites them is the way that they were covered in the 24-hour news cycle, then we can begin to see that these individual women, their characters were not problematic. It's that they were all victims of sexism. Mm.
This was supposed to be the decade of the woman. I mean, there was some real sense that, as you put it in the book, that the dream of gender equality is going to be realized. But that, of course, turned out to be a false hope. But there was so much promise at the beginning of the 90s that things were going to change. And it was, I think the Anita Hill hearings were kind of a crucial moment that got a lot of women involved in politics. And it seemed like things were headed in a certain direction. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, coming off of the 80s, we saw so many diverse female pioneers in different fields. Geraldine Ferraro was on a presidential ticket, and we saw Sally Ride travel to space. We saw Toni Morrison win the Pulitzer Prize for, you know, women-centered fiction. And so there was a sense among my generation that the achievements of these individual women would really lift all boats and that we would then benefit from what they had achieved. And so many of us believed that we were equal to our male counterparts, that we would be able to sort of access any and every opportunity that they also wanted to pursue. And yet, you know, as the 90s began, and particularly with the Anita Hill hearings, it became clear that this was not the case at all, that gender parity had not been reached. The Anita Hill hearings did motivate, you know, countless women to run for political office, which then resulted in 1992 being the year of the woman.
Yeah.
Though their numbers only rose from 2 to 6. Yeah. And it's there's so many parallels that are interesting to discuss with today, because we sort of are, you know, coming upon another year of the woman. Mm-hmm. So many are running for office again. The chances of them winning, you know, it's not clear what's going to happen. But we have also sort of seen how the promise of gender equality was failed in the 90s. And many of us can feel hopeless today, too.
Mm. One of the things you say is that the 90s, when you were looking at, barely seemed like history at all. It seems like that's one of the things that's really worrying you, is that we're not reflecting critically enough on that time to be able to learn the lessons of how, in fact, it didn't turn out to play out the way people hoped. And I'm guessing that's what you're hoping is we'll learn the lesson from that era.
We have to do a lot more digging. I think the big lesson from the era is not just the way in which these women were treated, yeah, but the effects that these narratives had on young women, on girls, on girlhood in the 1990s. So I write about in the book the extent to which these narratives really shaped the upbringing of young girls. Mm-hmm. We saw, you know, eating disorder behaviors, cutting behaviors, an increase in depression. Young women, you know, by the mid-90s were twice as likely to hate their bodies than boys. And these new changes in the way that girls were growing up are directly tied to the narratives that they were presented in the media, mm, and in teen magazines that sold them, you know, the bromide that they needed to be thin to be loved. Yeah. These things are all related. And I believe that women in my generation, and myself included, we looked at women like Monica Lewinsky, who in many ways, you know, indicated progress for women. She was, for 100 years, the median age of marriage was around 22 or 23, but by 1997, it was up to 27, which was tremendous progress. Mm-hmm. Young women were entering the workforce. They were delaying marriage and children. They were having, you know, sex outside of marriage thanks to the expansion of birth control. And they were working jobs and earning money. And that was, you know, that was progress. Mm-hmm. But many of us saw what happened to someone like Monica Lewinsky, who was, you know, sort of sexually confident and, you know, interning in the White House. What a desirable internship to have. And we saw the way that she was treated, and it really shaped the way many of us grew up and what we thought was possible in our lives. So I really want people to understand that this isn't just about the media treatment of Monica Lewinsky, yeah, or the media treatment of Anita Hill. It's really about the ways in which misogyny and sexism and the way stories of women unfolded in the 90s that limited what young women growing up that decade thought was possible for their lives. Mm.
Allison Yarrow, her book is called 90s Bitch, Media, Culture, and the Failed Promise of Gender Equality. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the Indie Bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West. So thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West and Book Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the bitchification of women in the 1990s. The 1990s was supposed to be the decade of the woman, but the journalist Allison Yarrow looked into that decade and says that's not actually what happened. Instead, she says women looking for power came to be seen as bitches. Her book is called 90s Bitch: Media, Culture, and the Failed Promise of Gender Equality. I want to come back to the conversation earlier when we were talking about the term bitch, which you, of course, said has a long history, a longer history than you realized, of basically, as you say, reducing women to their sexual function. And you described the word as a verbal weapon being designed to restrain women. Would you explain that? Explain how the term was consciously designed, because this was interesting.
Yeah, the word bitch really has constantly been used to reduce women to their sexual function. It started this way in sort of the Greek and Roman uses when women were called, you know, dogs who begged for men. You see the word bitch appear when a woman is stepping out of line, when she seems too angry or too sexual. It's a way to reduce her to her sexual function, and has been for a very long time. And we see that today. I mean, we see that when, I mean, a very recent example is the Access Hollywood tape, in which President Donald Trump, at the time he was not president, but admitted to, you know, sexual assault. And he says in the tape, I quote, "I move on her like a bitch." And there's that word. And it's being used to justify sexual assault. And so when the word is used, it's often, I believe there was another example recently where The Atlantic reported that a Trump associate, or I believe it was a White House spokesperson, the word bitch was used. Other countries were America's bitch, was basically the gist of what this Trump official said. And so we continue to see the word. What's problematic to me is the ways in which, and it's really interesting, I talk about the word bitch with women who are 10 years older than me and women who are 10 years younger than me. And here's the difference that I see. With women 10 years older than me, Gen X women, they can remember so clearly the first time they were called a bitch, you know, exactly where they were, how it made them feel. Women who are 10 years younger than me often say, I have no recollection of the first time that I was called a bitch, because I've been called a bitch so many times, it's lost its meaning. And it's actually a word that I also use. So there's less of a sense of sort of the gravity of this word and the history of this word and how it has been used to reduce women to their sexual function.
Is there anything at all good about that, in the sense that women wanting to take the word back and own it? Because that's one of the things you mentioned, is the term today, spit-shined, retooled, but also manipulated as a kind of sly marketing tool as well. Like, how is it used today if it's so ubiquitous that women 10 years younger don't even remember the first time they were referred to, because it's so much? I mean, is there anything good in that, I suppose?
I am suspicious of reclamations of the word bitch. We see it everywhere today. Boss bitches, resting bitch face. You can buy a shirt that says the word bitch on it. I just believe that I personally do not use the word. I'm not the language police. I won't tell others how they should or shouldn't speak and what words they should or shouldn't use. But I believe that we have to be mindful of context and also who is saying the word. But I think the word bitch has a long history of reducing women to their sexual function, and thus really should be investigated. And we should understand what we mean when we say it and why we're saying it. Also, the verb to bitch, to complain, also has negative connotations.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about TV in the 90s. You mentioned how women were portrayed on TV shows. You mentioned Beverly Hills 90210. A lot of fat shaming going on, you mentioned. You mentioned lingerie and the so-called power panties kicks in, that this lingerie trend comes into the scheme of things. And then there's this reality television that emerges. 1992, MTV debuts Real World, and then you get one of those kind of stock characters, the villain bitch, I guess. What are we seeing in the 90s television that you are documenting in the book?
90s television was full of examples of bitchification, masquerading as progress, starting with 90210. Many of us believe that, it's not unfamiliar, the idea of television speaking to a young audience. But 90210 was one of the first examples of a television show that really was about the experiences of high school kids. And it was sort of presented as this high school ideal that many very young kids were interested in watching. Mm-hmm. And even the show had marketing tie-ins with companies like Cheerios, which is a cereal marketed to very young kids. And so there was sort of this sense that this idealized version of high school, where, you know, women were judged based on how their bodies looked in bikinis, was the kind of environment that high schoolers wanted to be a part of. And then, you know, later we saw shows like Friends and Ally McBeal and Living Single that presented this really glorious looking life that young professionals could have, working in urban centers, you know, having sex outside of marriage, really new sort of roles and opportunities for women. But in many ways, these shows also presented very limited opportunities for women. Mm. I like to talk about Living Single because it was a really important show for Black women, yeah, working jobs and sort of being the center of attention in the show. And yet, their storylines sort of for the network bosses, really, it wasn't enough for the story to just be about independent women. The creator was asked to sort of, you know, boost the male characters and sort of give them more robust storylines. They couldn't just sort of be these stock characters that Yvette Lee Bowser, the creator of Living Single, had designed them specifically to be. Because for so long, television really traded in women just sort of being stock characters who were there to kind of support male characters' dilemmas and storylines. So, I mean, that was a really important show. And, you know, very soon after, Friends was created, and it was sort of this, you know, three men and three women, all white, in sort of an urban environment, working and dating, and very much like Living Single, but, you know, given a lot more money and a lot more latitude, and on NBC and not Fox, and sort of didn't give credit for being inspired by Living Single.
Yeah. I was interested in the section where you describe the 90s witches. There was a whole kind of genre, it seemed. What do you make of that?
So witchery and witches, that's been a way for women characters to have power and really interesting dialogue and sort of more robust roles than they typically are given. So we saw these examples during the 90s with shows like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which has an incredible and devout kind of feminist following even today. Also Sabrina the Teenage Witch, you know, sort of the female characters of Charmed. These women were able to sort of use magic to have sort of more robust storylines and more interesting activities and shows than you normally see when women are just, you know, secretaries or mother figures or daughter characters. Mm.
Explain what you mean by the Goldilocks conundrum in female sexuality, because this gets us to a conversation I want to have about the two scandals that you mentioned bookended the decade of the 90s, the Anita Hill hearings at the beginning, Monica Lewinsky at the end. What's the Goldilocks conundrum?
I write about the Goldilocks conundrum of female sexuality, being that, you know, there's sort of this idea of too hot and this idea of too cold, yeah. But there's also no such thing as just right. So the 90s really was sort of bookended by these two, if you will, sex scandals. In 1991, Anita Hill, because she charged sexual harassment, was painted as a frigid bitch, a scorned woman. She was determined to be too cold. At the end of the decade, you saw Monica Lewinsky. When that scandal unfolded, she, you know, giggled with Barbara Walters and filled her apartment with red roses and, you know, wrote love letters and was really confident about her sexuality. And so in many ways, she was really punished for that behavior more than the affair itself. She was deemed to be too hot. And so if those are sort of the bookends of the decade, these two stories of women being censured for their sexuality, it becomes really unclear what kind of female sexuality is acceptable in American society.
Yeah. When we're talking about the Anita Hill hearings and her story, it's remarkable the connection between Anita Hill and Christine Blasey Ford. Anita Hill has this initial desire for anonymity. The Judiciary Committee is reluctant to hear the testimony, but then she is determined to be heard. She doesn't have much time to prepare. There's this steady campaign to discredit her. I'm not sure how it's going to play out, obviously. We don't even know if she will testify at this point as we're having this conversation. But let's talk a little bit about the connections that you're seeing play out. Are you seeing some parallels here?
There are so many parallels. It's just haunting. Exactly. Blasey Ford initially desired anonymity, as Anita Hill did. Both were all too aware of the consequences that befall women when they charge sexual harassment or sexual assault or attempted rape. As if the events themselves are not traumatic enough, being, you know, sort of being a victim of one of those crimes, then having to come forward and recount that crime and be subject to the same kinds of attacks. You know, Anita Hill faced death threats and worse, and so has Blasey Ford. It's really shocking. I mean, what's also so disheartening is how nearly 30 years after the Anita Hill hearings, the Senate Judiciary Committee has no protocol for vetting and investigating and looking at charges of sexual harassment and assault and these kinds of behaviors, which are against the law. And we would think that having learned the lessons of the Anita Hill hearings, that some kind of structure or protocol would be in place for handling this right. And yet there is none. Mm.
You mentioned how Anita Hill was branded as this erotomaniac, which you say was this a powerful tool in the 90s to discredit assault and sexual harassment victims. Talk a little bit about that. I thought that was interesting, too.
The erotomaniac trope was used in the 90s to really make female sexuality into something very frightening. It kind of came about after the release of the film Fatal Attraction. And there were other movies that sort of played into this too, like Basic Instinct and The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. It was sort of this idea that a woman pursued a man, and if she was denied his affection, she turned murderous and she wanted to be out for revenge. And so it really, what it got at, the sort of heart of it, was that women could threaten powerful men and threaten their jobs and their livelihoods with their sexuality. And so the way that this played out for Anita Hill was that she was accused by Clarence Thomas's wife of being a fatal assistant. And then there was a psychologist named Park Dietz, who often would testify in celebrity cases, who sort of uncovered the term erotomaniac. And it filtered around, and people began to associate the Anita Hill hearings with this idea of erotomania. It was suggested that Hill herself was an erotomaniac because she had pursued Clarence Thomas, and yet he had denied her. That was the suggestion. And then during the hearings, or after the fact, there was an affidavit submitted by someone that Hill had previously worked with, who also said that he believed that she had been after his attention, had pursued him sexually. Mm-hmm. He had denied her, and thus, this was somehow proof that she was doing the same thing to Clarence Thomas. I mean, this is in the record. And so there was this sense that Hill, too, like the women in the movies Fatal Attraction and Basic Instinct, was an erotomaniac, that she was after the attention, the sexual attention of her boss, and that because she was thwarted, she was out for revenge, and she was looking to not only sully his reputation, but take down his chances of being appointed to the Supreme Court.
What are you hearing in some of the Republican senators who are dubious of Christine Blasey Ford's claims, or seem to be? People like Orrin Hatch, again, who's still there. He was on the committee, of course, when Anita Hill was testifying. He's going to be there when Christine Blasey Ford testifies, if she does. Saying that I think she's mistaken. It seems like they're being maybe more careful, or maybe not. I'm wondering if you're hearing the same kinds of dynamics in this case, or how they might be different.
Orrin Hatch was the senator in 1991 when he heard that charges had been made against Clarence Thomas, who said, whoever made these claims ought to be shot.
Yeah.
And so for him to say that, and today to say that Blasey Ford is mixed up, he has softened his language. And yet, I believe the sort of the kernel is the same, the sort of not believing women, believing men, not believing women, despite the mountains of evidence that women do not make up allegations of sexual harassment and assault, or that they should be heard, that these claims are worthy of being heard, that these actions, if it's investigated, if they're to have occurred, are unbefitting of someone who would be appointed to the Supreme Court. It's very disheartening when we hear someone like Orrin Hatch say that this woman is mixed up. He's not a member of the FBI investigating team. As far as I know, he doesn't have an expertise in sort of hearing cases related to this. And it's really, I believe, disheartening for so many women who have suffered sexual abuse or trauma or attempted rape to hear Blasey Ford's claims dismissed so systematically.
I want to ask you more about Monica Lewinsky, the other scandal that bookended the 90s. Their affair was not a fling, you point out. It spanned more than 2 years. And it's interesting that in the history books you say, we don't call it the Clinton scandal, we call it the Lewinsky scandal. What's that about, do you think?
That's right. It's about blaming her for the events. I think the scandal should be called the Clinton scandal. Monica Lewinsky entered the White House with an internship and then was hired for a position and had an affair with the President of the United States that spanned the course of 2 years, countless late-night phone calls. He made everyone. And they had what seems to be a relationship. And yet the way that the story unfolded really blamed her and sort of centered oral sex, which was a behavior, not sort of a characteristic of a relationship. So she was sort of attacked for being fat. Her neighbors were interviewed, and they said things like she wore lipstick from a very early age to suggest that she had sought male attention from the time that she was very young, as if that was proof of her guilt as well. Mm. She was really shaped into a perpetrator rather than a victim. And it really looks different now in sort of this post-Me Too landscape. Yeah. Sort of the power dynamics at work are very much more known. People are more interested in sort of seeing those power dynamics and the ways in which she was victimized.
Maureen Dowd called her a ditzy, predatory White House intern.
She did. Many journalists from top publications attacked Lewinsky for her, you know, appearance, what they imagined was her personality. Lots of folks did that. And I was being interviewed with one of the journalists who covered the Lewinsky-Clinton scandal for Newsweek. And I asked him sort of, and Newsweek was one of the, you know, Time, Newsweek, the sort of the really straightforward news organizations. These were not tabloids, but they really in many ways covered the Clinton Lewinsky scandal as if they were tabloids. And they were absolutely part of the media that portrayed Lewinsky as a predator, that editorialized about her sexuality. And I asked this journalist if, you know, given knowing what we know now about victims and perpetrators and sort of post-Me Too, would you cover the story differently? And he didn't say yes. Mm-hmm. And that to me was such an indicator of how far we have to go.
You mentioned, before you referred to this, I wanted to talk a little bit about what you call the girl power myth. It's a section in the book. There's this study done in 1991 called Shortchanging Girls, Shortchanging America. And researchers made this link between the self-esteem of girls and their experience at school. And there were other efforts that raised concerns about girlhood. Talk a little bit about this image of girls and their self-esteem and trying to attain this impossible idea of perfection.
Researchers in the 90s found that girls were losing their self-esteem at an alarming rate, you know, far faster than boys. By the time they were 8 years old, they were not participating in classes often because they feared sort of what that would be like. And what researchers really found was that girls were pursuing this idea of a perfect girl, this myth of a perfect girl. And it wasn't that they didn't know that this was impossible. Girls absolutely knew that perfection was impossible. And yet they still pursued becoming the perfect girl, despite knowing that. And it caused all sorts of problems, these, you know, sort of higher rates of depression, self-harm behaviors, eating disorders. And young women just, they really internalized the presentations of girls and girlhood in teen magazines, on television, these sort of perfectly thin bodies, you know, blonde, blue eyes. And there really wasn't a conversation about whether or not these sort of perfect images were real. Yeah. It seemed as if every celebrity sort of had the same thin body, and young girls believed that they needed to sort of pursue that body to be loved. And on the other hand, you know, many were learning that in their schools, they either had no sex education whatsoever, or they were being taught abstinence-only sex education, which was, you know, the prevailing method of sex education in America in the mid-90s, thanks to, you know, a multi-million dollar windfall through welfare reform. So young girls were not learning how to be confident or sexually confident or authentically sexual beings, and they were sort of pursuing this perfection ideal in place of having real sort of authentic girlhood. Mm.
The problem with those studies is that you say they identified a problem, but they didn't really explain how girls were supposed to get this self-esteem. They didn't kind of close the loop, it seems.
Right. Absolutely. It was hard to know how young women were to achieve self-esteem, though self-esteem was painted as a silver bullet that would fix everything. And there were, you know, government programs designed to sort of boost self-esteem and all kinds of efforts like this. But I remember, you know, being a girl growing up at that time, feeling like self-esteem was something that, you know, you had to have it, And if you didn't have it, you had to get it, but you didn't want to tell anybody that you didn't have it and that you were trying to get it, because that would be humiliating and you wouldn't be able to, you know, actually, you know, get it at all.
And you didn't know how to get it.
Right. No one told you how to get it.
Yeah.
As if it was a thing that you could get.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, so let's fast forward. People thought 2016 was going to be different, of course. And there were indications, you mentioned this in the book, that show things, of course, have improved. More women than men are likely to enter college, women besting their male counterparts in higher education, more women running for and winning public office. Of course, then there are the rates of teen pregnancy and abortion and eating disorders that are, you know, that are better. Not to mention, you say, the feminist internet, which has elevated these new voices. But then Donald Trump is elected. And in the book, you say it seems like history merely repeated itself. Explain what you mean.
History is very much repeating itself. And that is the case because we have yet to examine our very recent past. The 90s is barely history. We've moved on. There's a completely different media revolution now. We don't even consume the same stories at the same time today the way that we did in the 90s. But it can feel as if history has repeated itself because we haven't really contended with the sexism in our past, the misogyny, the chauvinism, the ways in which women are sort of a second gender to men. It's interesting to point out that during the 1990s, female television characters at the beginning of the decade were about 38% of the characters on television were women. And by the end of the decade, 39% of the television characters were women. So a 1% increase in a decade's time. And with our politics, I think, you know, with the release of the Access Hollywood tape and, you know, candidate Donald Trump admitting to sexually assaulting women, that was it for a lot of voters. A lot of voters said, you know, that they were disinterested in electing someone who would behave that way and brag about it. And yet he was elected. And I think it shocked a lot of people. And a lot of people now feel as though these kinds of behaviors are sanctioned and that somehow there is an entitlement to sexuality that men have that women do not. And that's really playing out, you can see, with the Me Too movement and the various protests that have been waged. And it's really, it can feel as though we are just in slow motion and we're really not moving forward at all. But the light at the end of the tunnel for me is, I believe now that we can see the sexism in our very recent past, in the 90s, we can see the way that the stories of Monica Lewinsky and Anita Hill and Hillary Clinton, the way that these are all related, once we see this sexism and this racism and these other isms, then we can begin to chart a path forward to change them. When they're hidden, when we can't see them at all, that's far more problematic.
What does the path forward look like in a general sense? I mean, you say that it's time to re-examine the stories that are told and sold about women. What does this look like? Are these conversations? Are these essays? Are these studies and examinations and more candid conversations in public? What is it like?
I think it's all of those things. I like to say that it can be difficult to have conversations about sexism and racism in our intimate spaces, but in many ways, those are the places where we can have the most impact. You know, I think there's this kind of trope of the Thanksgiving table and someone is sitting there with a family member who doesn't share their politics. So the best thing to do is probably to keep quiet, right? And not talk about politics. But in these times, at this moment, those are really the places where people can make the biggest impact. You probably have the ear of your uncle who doesn't share your politics. He probably loves you and would listen to what you have to say, even though it's different than what he believes. I think sometimes it can feel as though there need to be these essays and these studies and this proof of, discrimination and bias, but we know that it exists. And the way forward is to have difficult conversations with the people that we love about the things that we feel and that we believe, because we all hold biases, some consciously, some unconsciously, and we have to do the work to see where they are, and it's not comfortable. And we have to sort of admit that we have these biases and that we are willing to work on them and to change them.
So how are you looking at the midterms and this Me Too movement? It seems like this is a moment of opportunity, and I'm wondering, like, is this a test? And do you feel optimistic about whether we'll figure this out this time?
It's absolutely a test. I am optimistic. I'm from Georgia, and Stacey Abrams is running to be the first Black woman governor in the country. And that could happen in Georgia makes me so proud and so encouraged, particularly having grown up somewhere that, you know, there's racism and sexism and other isms that hide very well in chivalry and in many of the customs that are celebrated and beloved in the South. And to see that that could be possible there makes me so incredibly hopeful.
Allison Yarrow. Her book is 90s Bitch, Media, Culture, and the Failed Promise of Gender Equality. She joined us from a studio in New York City. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Holly Vasek. We had technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.